Greetings, the automatically deleted husband, and as you might expect, I got a card today! This one's different. This one was mailed in June, and I got it back today, 6 months later. It was not to my wife. It was to Jack. But Jack in South Carolina, and from some quick research, he may be in Georgia now. And the address concerns me because they're hints, but I don't know. But why did it take 6 months to return? That fascinates me. It leaves a lot of questions, but no strong clue of why. But anyway, that one puzzles me. But I mentioned yesterday a reminder. I gave you a link, and I'll give you the link again today to a previous voicemail about 3 John 4. I have no greater joy than hear that my children are walking in the truth, and I ask about my own family, because obviously I don't get that joy. I don't hear about my children. So I listened to them, and I found it very encouraging. And a couple things. One is I received huge encouragement today to press on with the activity I'm doing. Huge encouragement. And it was a joy as well as helpful. One of the things I did then was I took an afternoon hike and dropped my boots off to have heels yet again, and walked by the chin-up bar. And the last several times I did that, I couldn't do one. I've done it, or I've done several in a row, and of course the world famous 9-second chin-up, but I did one. I did one full, chin over comfortably over the bar. So that encouraged me, because I haven't done that in several months. The second one, I got up to the front of the chin. I didn't get it over the chin. So it was kind of, eh. So one full complete chin up. And that encouraged me, because, I do get, when you're really close now to knocking on the door at 67, you wonder if your body might not be as strong as it used to be. Well, it never was strong enough to do a chin-up. So, anyway. I went to Publix, to make sure I had some bananas as the remaining ones were running low. Got that started walking back home. So, I did an 8-mile hike today, which was encouraging. But as I was walking back, a good ways ahead of me was a young lady walking much slower than I was. So a few minutes later, I was catching up with her, and she may have heard, the clack clack of the boots, and turned and saw me. And then when she turned around, I saw she wasn't wearing a little mask. She was wearing a big mask. And she did the thing that I've seen before. She walked off into the grass to let me pass. Because of the traffic noise, I figured, okay, I don't want to shout and be loud and whatnot about this. So I just kept walking. But I do wonder, I have been wondering, do I ask somebody, why are you living in fear? You're living in fear of what authorities tell you. You're living in fear of what authorities tell you. Evidence tells you the masks cause you self-harm and are useless to prevent, to protect others. So what you're doing is useless, maybe harmful to yourself, but you're living in fear because authorities have told you. Not that there's evidence, just the, you're listening to an authority. And that really concerns me because of, you've seen hints of the mask issue coming back. And I saw it again. I saw it with this one lady. And I think, if I recall correctly, I may have seen one or two people elsewhere, store somewhere else, wearing a mask again. And it's kind of like, this does concern me. You know, it is the issue of when I deal with people, because, you know, more often than not, I make my purchase at Publix or other places with cash. And when the cashier has trouble making change or requires the cash register, or if there's a manual adjustment to do arithmetic in their head, they can't. They have to use a calculator or something. That really concerns me. Because if you can't do simple math, when the complex things happen, like you should wear a mask, or we're gonna give you this you know, federal program, you know, like the UBI, you know, which seems to be coming on strong, you know, the universal basic income. Oh, that sounds like wonderful, whatnot. And you have no idea how you're being enslaved, because you can't add. If you can't add, you won't be able to figure out the more complicated numbers. It's like figuring out the very relatively minor statistics issues about evolution. I'm sorry. It takes so much faith to believe in evolution. It's ridiculous. But one of the things I thought about in because it seemed to relate to that extremely well. So I'll leave you the link again of the December 22nd voicemail, which I thought was, you know, again, that it talked about 3 John. And I mentioned the thing about that's when Zelensky was here speaking at the U.S. Congress. And I mentioned the Babylon Bee's article that foreign invaders invaded the Capitol and stole $50 billion, which was very accurate. But they said it extremely well. They said it extremely well. So, but what I've noticed, and I've heard a lot of people mention, well, you won't hear it mentioned in most Western media, because obviously Western media is doing the PR for Ukraine, for the anti-Russian narrative and all those kind of things, because we need a boogeyman. You know, the boogeyman, you know, it wasn't too long ago, everything Islamic was bad. We don't hear much about that now. Now, everything Russian is bad. What's the difference? One is the word Islam, one is the word Russian, but otherwise it's the exact same thing. It's the boogeyman. You have to have a boogeyman, because once you have a boogeyman, now we can rally against, say, how bad the boogeyman is, and you need us to protect you, because the boogeyman's coming out to get you. They're going to come take your children! You know, it's literally the World War II images about the Huns coming to get your kids, and protect your kids. Same thing. It really is the same thing. But you may recall, you know, in the southern part of Ukraine, you know, and the eastern part is the Donbass region, the Donetsk and Lugansk, the two regions that broke off formally, semi-formally with the Minsk Accords back in 2014. And then you had Minsk II as a peace agreement, which the West violated. Not the Donbass, not the Russians, the West violated. And you had something like 14,000 civilians die in the Donbass region. And so obviously the Russians are bad. Ukrainians killed people that were in the country of Ukraine, so therefore the Russians are bad. Let me think about that. I'm listening to the PR. For example, one of the things I heard is that, I think it's the UN numbers say 7,000 civilians have died thus far in Ukraine in 2022. I think that's right. But what does that mean? Ukraine, as in the borders from 2021, for example, or the borders now as the West sees it, or as Russia and the Donbass see it, Russia, the Donbass now being part of Russia as the Russians see it. So when you say 7,000 civilians dead, do you include the Donbass? Because the reason that's important is, you know, for example, there was the missile that hit an apartment complex, and they're making a lot of this in Dnipro, because it was a large missile. It slammed into an apartment complex, killed, I think it was 30-some people, whatnot. Civilians. And it's, look how bad the Russians are. They're killing civilians. But the issue is, the Ukrainians have admitted that was a Russian missile, and it was not heading, it was not targeting that building, but a missile defense system hit it, only deflected it because it still blew up. But it blew up in a civilian apartment complex instead of the target it was going for, because it's abundantly clear the Russians have been targeting the infrastructure. Why do the Russians target the Ukrainian infrastructure, the electrical system and whatnot? It's because, for example, the train system runs on electricity. You eliminate transportation around, so you cannot deliver, for example, the military and the military vehicles from one side of Ukraine to another. It's strategic warfare, and it doesn't kill civilians by doing that. You hit rational military targets, and you're not killing people. But now you don't have the resources to bring, for example, the military equipment that you have in the western part of the country to the east, to the Donbass, and so forth. That's why it was being done. But you look and you say, all right, this missile hit this apartment complex. Obviously, the Russians are targeting civilians. That's what's portrayed. But the Ukrainians, somebody apparently resigned because of this, have admitted, yeah, well, we shot down and we didn't really shoot it down because we didn't destroy the missile. We deflected it and it hit the apartment complex. So you do what you can in the news to say the Russians are bad, rather than saying, we tried to deflect a missile. We tried to destroy a missile. We only deflected it, and it caused a tragedy. Because that's the reality. It's not to say the Ukrainians are bad because they tried to deflect or destroy a missile. In the act of war, a missile's coming in. It's rational to say, destroy that missile because we don't want it to hit its target. But sometimes it doesn't work that well. So it's not that somebody did a bad thing by trying to shoot it out of the air. It's just that the results turned out to be tragic because it hit a civilian apartment complex rather than landing in a field somewhere. You know, if it landed in a field somewhere, it would have been, we successfully deflected or stopped this missile from hitting its target. But instead, we tried and we paid it. Big price for it. Reminds me of the thing I mentioned about the Lot, Levites, and Yazidis. You know, where in the case of Lot, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by the Lord. Basically, no innocent parties were injured, except, you know, Lot's wife had her issue. But then at the end of the book of Judges, the Levite, whatnot, was it 40,000 died, which you might call kind of innocent parties in the situation. It's that kind of thing. You're striving to do the right, what you think is the right thing, and problems occur. So it's not, it's you don't, when you say, oh, the Russians are bad because they hit a civilian, you're lying. It's propaganda. You're lying. The Russians were shooting at a military target. The defense system worked partially, and we had a tragic result. It's not we blame the Ukrainian military for not trying. We look at the circumstances. This is the tragedy of war. And to put a blame on either side, I think, is wrong. The question is, should you be shooting missiles in the first place while you're in war? Then, you know, the more fundamental question should be war, but that's a whole nother thing. But anyway, backing up a bit, you know, I said that I think it was the UN that said 7,000 civilians have died. Is that 7,000 Ukrainians, you know, Ukrainian speaking, culturally Ukrainian on the western part? And does it exclude those in the Donbass? Or is it all of Ukraine, including the Donbass? There's an important difference, because the connotation is the Russians are killing civilians only, or they've killed 7,000 civilians. That's the connotation of the way it's presented, but that's not what the information is. If the information is only the Ukrainians in the West, then you say, okay, yes, that's a lot of civilians that have died. Of course, it's over 100,000 soldiers have died. I mean, Ukraine is losing a lot of soldiers. I mean, somewhere between 3 and 10 times more what the Russians are losing. I mean, the Ukrainians are losing this war militarily, badly. Or was that number, that 7,000 figure, including the Donbass? Because if it's including the Donbass, civilians in Donbass are being slaughtered. And so if it's including that, that could be maybe 1,000 of the 7,000, or it could be over half. And that piece of information would take the connotation away and give you the reality of what's being said. I don't know. I don't have the answer. But I do know how to point out the question. What is being said? Is it saying that the Russians are bad alone because 7,000 Ukrainian civilians have died? Or are we saying 7,000 total, including the Donbass? And by the way, the Ukrainians are shooting huge numbers of missiles, including HIMARS and things of that nature, U.S.-supplied missiles, into the Donbass, targeting civilians over and over and over again. This is clear, abundant. This is obvious. You can find report after report after report, but not in the Western media. Because the Western media, it's like in Afghanistan now. You see a Muslim terrorist. You don't understand. There's no indication there's the Sunni-Shia divide within Islam. We're seeing played out within Afghanistan. And especially after the U.S. exited, there was a whole bunch of Sunni terrorist attacks against Shia mosques. But it's just Islam. You know, so it's they're all bad kind of thing. And you can use it and give a connotation of one thing when the reality is another. But see, and I think this is important. But I put yet another video. It's only a 1-minute video from RT. It's now on Kozlowska.org. And so the link is there. Because you may recall several months back, Mariupol. You know, the Donbass is on the east. Then the southern part, you know, the Crimea is almost kind of like an island. It's the peninsula. There is a land, you know, land bridge connection to the rest of Ukraine. But it kind of almost looks like an island, but it is connected. But then there's those southern areas, including Mariupol, which had the, I think it was called Azovstal, the steel plant. This thing was huge. It was built in the Soviet era. And so it's huge. And this is where the Azov Battalion, these are the Nazi groups, held up for a long time. And what happened was they ended up at the steel plant because it's basically on the water and it could be isolated. And so the Russians just, okay, run away. And they literally starved them out. And when they finally said, okay, we give up. They said, okay, you come out, single file line, and you're going to be examined. And what happened was they came out And they were examined to, you know, in a line. Do you have, let's look at your tattoos. If you had the Nazi tattoos, you're a prisoner. You're a prisoner of war. If you didn't, most of those people were freed. So, you know, I mean, it was that simple. But during that time, there was a lot of fighting. And one of the things that's important to understand is that, you know, a lot of the culture there is based on Soviet era mentality, which we're seeing more and more of in the U.S. But so people were moved into cities, becoming factory workers and whatnot, and lived in high-rise apartments. So high-rise apartments became the dominant culture. Obviously, we see it in the big cities. It's a problem. It's a big problem. And this is the mentality. This is the reason for there's it's called. You can see it. There's a map of the U.S. where they're trying to make certain areas within the U.S. for animals and plants only, and get people out, get them into cities. I mean, this has been a concerted effort within the U.S. as well as around the world, but specifically in the U.S. to get people out of the rural areas into cities, because in cities you're controllable far more. Well, you have it culturally there in Russia, Poland, a lot of places there, but especially where the Soviets had that domination and instilled that lifestyle, because you're part of the collective, and collectives collectivize, and one of the ways you do that is apartment complexes, because we're all working at the factory, such as the Avastal steel mill. Was huge, employed huge numbers of people, and therefore you had mass transit and all those kind of things, because you lived in an apartment complex, you got on mass transit to go to stores and whatnot, and then go to the factories. That's the way those towns worked, the factory towns. And this is common there in Ukraine as well as so many other places. But Mariupol is very much a factory town in that sense. And then we had all the of course there was a whole lot of PR. There's too many things, but one of the things that happened is a whole lot of these apartment complex buildings were hit, damaged, or destroyed. Lots of them. There are some issues. A lot of people, because again, this is. In the Donbass, it's extremely Russian. In the Mariupol area, it's mostly Russian in the sense of culture and language. But not as, you know, that's why when they did the vote, it was like 98% wanted to be part of Russia in Donetsk and Lugansk. But in Mariupol and the other places, it was only like in the 80s. Because there was a lot more Ukrainian, culturally Ukrainian people there. Makes sense. But what happened is that once Mariupol was freed of the Ukrainian military, you know, the city had become devastated. Within days, things like mass transit, whatnot, was back up and running. Because the Russians came in forcefully, in a sense, and said, we're getting the city back to life. And they did. And they took a lot of these buildings. And I've seen some various reports how they would go there, kind of, okay, we level this area and we rebuild these high-rise apartments. And we're going to do it now. And they did a PR piece. You know, one of the things that's been said is the Russians are really bad at PR. You know, Zelensky and whatnot, you know, him standing at the U.S. Congress. That's good PR in the sense that it's well done. I mean, lying through his teeth. But in the sense of the effectiveness of the PR, Zelensky does it a whole lot better than Vladimir Putin, by far. That's clear. Well, again, he is a literal comedy actor. I mean, that's what he did. He was a comedy actor. What's his name? the billionaire oligarch. Can't think of his name. Kolomoisky funded him, promoted him, and got him in office. I mean, he is literally a puppet. And he has, but so he's the figurehead and he can deliver the line. Whereas Putin doesn't deliver the line well. He does, the one that delivers the line well is Lavrov. That guy, I've heard this from lots of people. When you look at the foreign minister, secretary of state, whatever the office is titled, Lavrov takes the cake around the world. Compare the guy from China, from Germany, from UK, whatnot, US. Blinken is just, But Lavrov, he is skilled. A few weeks ago, when Anthony Blinken went to tour a bunch of places in Africa, and Lavrov did just before, just after, and it was kind of like they looked at Blinken as the laughingstock, literally, and the respect given to Lavrov was tremendous, which I think reflects on the way the rest of the world looks at the U.S. compared to Russia, or now BRICS. BRICS is becoming a really big deal, but anyway. This video, what they did today, one of these new apartment complexes is now ready for being occupied. So they had a ceremony, and they did a 1 minute PR piece, which was done beautifully. Really, I mean, this was good PR in the sense of Mariupol families receive keys to brand new apartments. So this guy here, he's the mayor, they have the ribbon cutting ceremony, and they're handing keys to families. And, the PR behind that is fantastic. And that is probably, in this entire year of this thing's been going on, that is the first time I've seen the Russians do a good PR piece. Ukrainians do it all the time. They do it all the time, especially the Al Jazeera reports. The PR is just fantastic, full of baloney, but it's fantastic in the quality of the delivery. This was excellent delivery. My concern, it is still that collective idea. That is the culture, which I find very unfortunate. That concerns me. But that's far less of a deal than some of the other things. But still, so I wanted to share that, because I was really surprised. So you have for today on the website, you have Zelensky standing at the U.S. Congress, and you have the mayor of Mariupol passing out keys. I would suggest the mayor did far more important work than Zelensky did as Babylon Bee says, stealing $50 billion from the U.S. And again, remember, that wasn't $50 billion that comes from the U.S. taxpayer that goes to Ukraine people. No, that was $50 billion. A few billion will end up, in Ukraine in the form of military. And of course, a lot of it is to support the billionaire. The billionaire, Zelensky. he is a billionaire. But most of it cycles right back into the military-industrial complex. So it wasn't for Ukraine. It was for the military. Or, the military, the money behind it. So, again, that's fraud. Whereas in this case, my concern is these are probably state-owned apartment complexes and whatnot. That stuff, that bothers me. But there's a difference between a state-owned apartment complex allowing people to live and a state-owned HIMARS missiles killing people in their apartment complex in Donbass, for example. Yeah, I'm more inclined to the one over the other. Somehow, this you shall not murder I think still is applicable. And unfortunately, the U.S. as an entity is doing that over and over and over and over again. You know, it's Madeleine Albright, you know, again, a Secretary of State, her infamous line, "We think the deaths of 500,000 children in Iraq was worth it." That's the U.S. for you. Anyway. So all sorts of wonderful things. Okay, one last thing. I had, before I took my hike, I had a dialogue with Chris. And because one of the things we've talked about for some time, and we were on other things, but we got back to this, because on so many areas, you cannot get, as I say, a jar of love. I cannot hand you a jar of love. It's not a quantity. So one of the things we, you know, discussed again is, if I give away all I have and I deliver my body to be burned and have not love, I gain nothing. The 1 Corinthians 13. So it's, if I do this, you know, this is something quantifiable. I have taken everything I have and I give it away. I've taken my physical body and done whatever it takes, and it ends up effectively my body be burned. In other words, I have sacrificed my life for something. But if I don't have love, none of that is worth a hill of beans. But have not love, I gain nothing. And then, of course, it's love is patient, love is kind, love is not envy or boast, it's not arrogant or rude, it does not insist in its own way, it is not irritable or resentful, it does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, adores all things. Love never ends. None of those things are a quantity that I can hand you. I can't hand you a quantity of rejoicing with the truth. I can't hand you a quantity of not insisting in my own way. I can't put that in a jar. The analogy is James 1:27, because, you know, the true religion or true worship is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and keep themselves unstained from the world. That's not a quantity of something I can do. These things, I cannot give you love in a jar. The only way to give you love is to really give you me. And the important thing that I think is so vital is this idea in verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 13, love never ends, or love never falls off. So if you ever say, I used to love this person, you're deceived or you're a liar. Because love never ends. If you used to love a person, no, you didn't. You used to lust a person. You used to feel good about a person. You used to have pride about your relationship with a person. You didn't love them. Because by definition, love never ends. Ends. And what is the definition of love? God is love. It's not a quantity. It's not, love isn't, you can't get love in a jar. I find this really important. And again, it is the constant reminder. And one other thing that we related, because Chris mentioned, you know, one of the things I find Chris does a whole lot better than I do, we bring up something and he says, it's this book, this chapter, this verse. Kind of like, oh, I can't do that. He does that remarkably better than I do. But I have the tools. But he pointed out in Romans 12:1, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may test, by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. There's a relationship here with the love thing. To present your bodies not as a burnt offering, the 1 Corinthians 13, but as a living sacrifice. In other words, I'm giving you me, not sacrificing my body, which is holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. What is true worship? The James 1:27. I would contend there is a consistency in Scripture about this. Our goal, you know, because one of the things we've been discussing is that the idea of meriting something or that a moral life will get you into heaven. No, it's yes, we're called to be obedient to Christ, but it's grace. It's God's grace alone. And the fundamental is not, I gave money to this. I've sacrificed my body to that. I have the faith to move a mountain. No, I love. That shows the Lord has me, that I love. That love may turn out to be material in the sense that, I give away all I have, or I deliver my body to be burned. In other words, I may, as an act of love, literally sacrifice my life to someone else. But if my purpose is the pride idea or whatnot, no. If my purpose is I need to love that person is about to die, I'm going to risk it all to protect him. If I die, I die. Fine. My goal is not to do something noble. My goal is, how do I love that person? There's a difference. There's a big difference. Anyway, you can't get love in a jar. That's the focus. You can't get love in a jar. So I would like to know why I got, after 6 months, this card back from Jack. And apparently, he does appear he has moved. I want to celebrate. I did a chin-up today. Yes! And I did send my postcard, the simple, happy birthday to George, with the assumption it's going to arrive approximately on his birthday, because, you know, I'm not sure how long it takes to get there. And then, of course, my assumption is I'll have it back probably in less than 6 months. And I do think it's worth noting the difference in the PR of Ukraine, as in what we saw Zelensky at the U.S. Congress and this gentleman, the mayor of Mariupol, handing out keys. Both are, in a sense, PR. What's behind them is radically different. And I do think you need to be careful. Oh, yes, because I am, you know, I did the thing on, the whistleblowers, and then applied it specifically to the sex slave. And the other thing that I've been working on, it's on the Shofar League site already, the idea of how we can use. And I've been thinking this through because obviously I'm trying to apply it myself. Use the technology to pursue reconciliation. Because the objective here, as I had a dialogue a while back, the objective is not revenge. The objective is reconciliation. If your objective is revenge, you're not following in obedience to Christ, because Christ says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. We don't seek vengeance, period. So how do we seek reconciliation? How do you seek reconciliation with somebody who's harmed you? I want to do that myself. And just as I want to put in the hands of someone who is, again, I use the general term whistleblower, how do you protect them? And then how, protect them for what they do, protect them after the fact. Protect them in the sense, as I gave the example of the sex slave. Protect them also in not even the technology, but also explain to them, if you're going to be a whistleblower, you're probably going to make a bunch of mistakes. And let me warn you about that. I want to do that too. That has nothing to do with technology. But then the reconciliation process. If you say, okay, I'm the whistleblower, I'm yay, yay. But have no desire to reconcile with those that you, the collective that you have offended. if you don't want to reconcile and you blew the whistle on something that was right, you're no better than those that you blew the whistle against. That's important. And within that collective that you blew the whistle against, there are a lot of people there that may reconcile with you. The problem is reconciliation is really hard. Lower the barrier to reconciliation, even if it's to reconcile with some. That is what I want to pursue. Myself, and then obviously to give those tools to others. Either give the tools to them in the sense of the technology, or at least proclaim it. Proclaim to somebody, if you're after vengeance, you know you're no different than the person you blew the whistle against. You're the same thing. But if you blow the whistle, call out the sin, and then try to reconcile, then I would suggest you're reflecting Christ well. Boy, another short video. You can't get love in a jar. That'll be the focus. You can't get love in a jar. This is said by a man who did a chin-up today. Anyway, my lady, my wife, wouldn't that be wonderful? Isn't your passion there? When you looked at me, you say, oh, he drives a BMW. That's my joy. Or is it he's a pro-life activist, a man striving to be obedient to Christ? Is that your joy? Or maybe is it when he gets to be almost 67 and can still do a chin-up? That's the man I want, right? I hope so. Because I love you, my lady, my wife. Beyond question, I love you. And I want you back.